from the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Well, good morning, you little pumpkins. Organic pumpkins, of course. And this is One Radio Network. It is November 7th, 2017. Good to have you here. All right. Well, George Altgeld is here, and you will meet George in just a second after I take care of a little business. And we're going to talk a lot about vegetables and minerals, gardening, inside, outside, around the bend, and down your street, and all this stuff. And you can do that, 888-663-6386. Don't be shy, 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. I think it's the last day for the Surthrival sale. 10% till midnight tonight. Promo code OneRadio if you want to get some colostrum or pine pollen. Our preliminary results of our three-month super-duper microbiome mouth testing, Dr. Ellie Phillips, is incredibly positive. I went to Dr. Nunley's place yesterday. I won't spill the beans right now, but Dr. Phillips is trying to get our DNA test that we had done last week today or tomorrow. If she can get it, we're going to do a show on Thursday so we'd have all the information. If not, we'll postpone it to next week. But so that might be something to look forward to if you've been following our little experiment with a very unconventional way to get rid of gum disease and get all the bacteria all happy together, playing together, and not trying to kill the bacteria, which is Dr. Ellie Phillips. So maybe we'll be able to chat with her on Thursday if we can get that DNA test back. So George Altgeld is here, and George talks a lot about the microbiome and the whole keeping things happy in the soil. George, good morning.
Good morning, Patrick.
How you doing, George?
Man, I'm doing great.
Well, you sound great, George. George studied chemistry, cellular and molecular biology, University of Texas. He also minored in girls. Well, that was good, George. I'm glad you did that.
Yeah, it was a good choice.
It was a good choice. I liked it. And you started Austin's first organic nursery in 71.
In 1971, yes, I did.
That was before it was even cool.
That's right. It was practically unknown.
Really, in 71?
Right, right.
Yeah, I guess
organics was just getting a foothold, and no one had ever thought about doing it for the nursery business or for horticultural enterprises.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, because I guess when did John Mackey and Mark Skiles do that first food, first store? What was it called?
Well, the first store that he actually got involved with.
Yeah, George knows all the history. Tell the people about the history.
Sure.
Yeah.
There was a little health food store right near the campus next to a cafe called Les Amis.
Oh, I remember that one, yeah.
Yeah, Les Amis. And about the only thing I could afford there was a cup of coffee.
That's right. That's because you were a hippie, George.
Well, actually, I was a construction worker, and I would stop in for a cup of coffee after work. And next door to it was this little health food store, and they still sold sugar alternatives.
Uh-huh.
And had quite an array of foods. And I was way into it, and I watched that store move into what became Safer Way.
Okay, what was the name of the original? Do you know?
I wish I could tell you.
Yeah, there. I used to know the name of that. I still do.
Me too.
It's I'll have to ask John Mackey. But then they kind of merged with a couple people and they called it Safer Way.
Right. That's when Mackey was involved, and it had the original owners as they got stock. And
right, yeah.
And, you know, years went by, and then I ran into the wife of one of the original owners, not John Mackey, and she said, it's been great. She said the stock splits, you know, the incentives by, you know, with stock, they've been fabulous. And it's like, wow. So that, you know, that they really did keep the original owners.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. I think it was Craig Weller, Mark Skiles, some other people like that. So then the whole food started, what, 79 or 80? 80 maybe?
Yeah.
81,
you know, it could have been 81. It's whenever the big flood was, and that whole place went underwater.
Yeah, I know.
And everyone thought, oh, that's the end of Whole Foods. But Mackey had some good backing, and they said, look, this thing can work. Let's just, you know, clean it up, reopen it, and keep going.
Yeah,
and that's what they did.
So at 71, though, that was pretty bold of you to be starting our organic. What kind of place was it, like a nursery? Did you do soil?
Austinites may remember the Jungle Store, and here at Geo Growers, people will come in and I'll recognize them. We started the store in 71, and what we had back then, we switched over from chemical fertilizer to fish emulsion.
Oh.
And that ended so many of our pest problems. And of course, you know, if you have a nursery, you have to be inspected. There's a state agency that inspects nurseries. And the guy who came in to inspect it said, this is the cleanest nursery anywhere in town.
Really? So people...
And, you know, I didn't expect that.
So people were selling piles of dirt, like you do now, different soils, but they were actually chemical soils?
Well, no, I wasn't selling soil back then. I was just selling plants.
Just plants, I'll be doing.
And I got involved in selling soil because potting soil was expensive to buy, and it wasn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the first person to actually microbially activate a potting soil. And that soil was called Thunderhead potting soil.
Thunderhead, I remember.
No, it was called Amazon River Basin potting soil. There we go.
Uh-huh.
It didn't become Thunderhead until after I lost Amazon River Basin potting soil to my ex in a divorce.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's always, you know, that's a great line, right? Like, what's the line I always love? Is something like, I used to live in San Francisco in a big house, and now I live in my car. After divorce. That's what happens.
right. Yeah, I got all the bills, and she got all the profit-making income streams.
God love the judge, you know. Here comes the judge. Oh, that's amazing. So
but just to add a little bit to that story, what we had for pest control, the real problem I had was scale. And scale in its juvenile form moves around. It can crawl, and then it lodges somewhere, and it starts to suck the sap from the cells of the leaf, and it will form a little shell over the top.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I don't know what the conventional method was with something toxic, but you can bet it was pretty toxic. But what we used was oilicide. And you mix the oil with water, and it's got an ammonia compound in it so that the ammonia enables the oil to mix with water. Otherwise, you know, oil and water don't mix.
Right.
Anyway, you spray it on there. It coats the insect. The insect, the scale in this case, suffocates. And then the oil itself evaporates. And so there's not even a residue in about 3 weeks. There's nothing left of that.
And the scale is a little bug? It's a little critter?
Well, it looks like a little hemisphere, and it'll stick to a leaf, and, you know, you can knock them off of there manually, but when a plant really gets a lot of scale, it's nearly impossible. Mm-hmm. But if you spray it with oilicide, it'll kill them all, and the next thing you know, they're not spreading, and they're pretty much dead, and you just kind of shake the leaf, and they fall off of there.
Uh-huh. I've never heard of that scale. So It's more than a bacteria. It's a little bit higher consciousness than a bacteria or a fungus.
Yeah, it's certainly visible. It's like if you put three pinheads together, that's about as big as an adult scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're a tough customer, and they usually get on plants. You see them a lot when there's not enough ultraviolet, and a plant can't make all the plant defense chemicals required to keep the scale off of there, so it succumbs, and scale can just take over.
So that's the way it is generally, George Altgeld, with plants. They get weakened because of what, lack
because
of...
Because something is missing.
Something's missing, kind of like people, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly. In the last, 15 years or so, I've been studying trace minerals and the trace mineral factors in how a plant builds its defense. And the plant defense chemicals are all built around mostly, there's alkaloids and, there's aromatics, but polyesterase, there's a whole bunch of compounds that are all based on copper. And polyphenol esterase is the foundation of almost every plant defense chemical. And you have to have that. It makes everything from tree bark to the pigments that are actually in the skin of the fruit that allows it to protect itself from too much ultraviolet.
So if you just go out and dig a hunk of dirt out of the woods or something, does it have the right ratios of copper and all that stuff in there?
Well, it depends on the woods where you go and dig it up.
Yeah.
Many parts of Texas have been overgrazed, and there's almost no woods left in some of these places. And so the plants are deficient in minerals because there hasn't been enough soil there for the last 80 to 100 years due to overgrazing.
Oh,
but
all
of that's changing now. We're becoming, I would say, veritable masters at managing pastures now. The NP and K model, although prevalent and dominant, is definitely losing ground to the enlightened ranchers who are cultivating the native grasses. They're not really doing anything except to allow the grasses to grow and proliferate.
Mm-hmm.
And the grasses in a pasture, they build the soil up. In fact, it's called pedogenesis, which is, how you build soil. And one of the fastest ways to build soil is through livestock when it's intelligently managed.
Oh, so back in the day, When buffalo were roaming around and they were eating and pooping and all that, and they just moved around, things went well, generally?
Generally. I'd say, herds of estimates run 27 million to 40 million buffalo were out there.
Wow.
Population's doing quite well.
Wow.
Yeah, and the grass was just building up soil. So it was so thick. You could cut sod into bricks and build a house.
I'll be darned. Because there was enough land available for the amount of... That seemed like a lot of buffalo that you could mess up the land pretty easily. But I guess the whole western part of the country was just nothing, right? Except
it was vast grassland until they started farming it, and that's how we got the Dust Bowl.
Huh.
But here's the interesting thing about a bison, a buffalo.
Yeah.
They will eat the grass down to about, an eighth to a quarter of an inch. And that's an extreme case. If they're moving around, they don't eat it that low. But bison don't eat the grass down to the roots. And because of that, the roots are always there to come back with more blades of grass, more foliage.
Huh.
And that's the difference between the cow and the bison. Although they are both bovines.
Do they both have a bunch of tummies and do the whole cow thing?
Yes, they all have four stomachs.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another interesting thing about buffalo and cattle. If you've ever watched cattle and seen them lick their noses, their tongue goes all the way up inside their nasal cavity, right through the nostril.
Really?
And when they're licking their noses and their faces and their lips, they are actually re-inoculating their lips with what's required for the soil. And that licking and eating the grass is how soil ecology builds around that particular herd animal. And both bison and bovine cattle do that.
You mean, so they're licking their face and getting all the good bugs or whatever, not good or bad, but just bacteria in general are And they're going back, and it teaches the grass to put in what they want, what they need.
Right, right. It's pretty all clever. Part of the soil ecology. It's all built around in a big circle.
Pretty clever.
Yeah, it's really clever. And once you start seeing stuff like that, that's when you get the idea that nature has been allied with itself for time immemorial.
Yeah, yeah. So I suspect that most grazing animals do that in Africa, and hyenas and whatever, and all these. It's probably the same thing that's going on.
Yeah, it's the same thing that's going on. Caribou, which are heavily migratory in Canada, are also providing similar things. And not to discount the benefit that comes from these animals are pooping out the remains of the grass.
Sure.
And here's the interesting thing about that. They have four stomachs. And what happens is all of the food energy is stripped away from the cellulose that is basically the foundation of what it is they ate. And that cellulose, minus all of the food energy, is pretty much indestructible after it's pooped out the back end. And it will continue to reduce in volume for a while, but when you get down to the last of it, what's left is the grass has something called lignin. And there are also polysaccharides. The lignin and the polysaccharides are what begin the process of building up soil. And that's why, you know, livestock is one of the best things you can do to build soil.
But I thought I heard you say the livestock is what screwed it up, but it's poor management and overgrazing.
Poor management, that's why I said the intelligent grazing, you know, the enlightened grazing that's being done now, especially here in Central Texas, is just a boon for building soil.
Because you just move them around.
Right. In fact, with electric fencing now, that is so efficiently well done that that you can raise a lot more cattle on a piece of ground than you did. In the old days, they just moved the herd in there. The herd would overgraze. And remember, cattle will eat the grass down to the roots and actually kill the grass. And what's left are the noxious weeds, you know, which, you know, cattle don't eat very much of unless they get some indication they should eat that. But so many of the weeds are pretty poisonous. You know, what happens is the pasture is just taken over by weeds that, you know, no cow would eat, you know, and that's where Texas went for more than a century is from the overgrazing.
Oh, so the farmers didn't know that. They just let them out there and cows just ate it down to the dirt.
Right, ate it down to the dirt and there was nothing left and the weeds took over. And, you know, the weeds have the benefit, too, because without them, you wouldn't recreate the ecology to grow grass.
Mm-hmm. George Altgeld is with us. We have a lot to talk about this morning. He'll be around for a little while. 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Hear this. Dr. Stephanie Seneff, Senior Research Team, MIT, answers a question from one of our listeners.
There are certain things that would help us to clear these things out and help the body to begin heal.
I think sulfur. I think eating a great deal of sulfur-containing foods and also soaking in Epsom salt baths, because you need to beef up your sulfur supply in order to generally be able to fight, to allow your liver to heal. So you're sort of, once your liver can heal, then you can detoxify, you know. So you really need to work on getting the liver healthy, and one of those crucial issues for that is the sulfur. Those enzymes are affected by all kinds of different toxic chemicals, and glyphosate prevents the body from disposing of those chemicals. Because of disrupting, glyphosate actually really disrupts the sulfur cycle in a big way. It interferes with sulfate transport. Of course, it doesn't allow the activation of vitamin D, and vitamin D protects you from sulfate flushing through the kidneys.
Sulfur, sulfur, sulfur. We love it. Pure organic sulfur. Three prices, United States, Canada, and worldwide. Click and order 24/7 right here. OneRadioNetwork.com. George, I didn't plan this, but are you seeing a lot of talk about this whole glyphosate sulfur cycle thing around?
And that's why I'm getting around to how this is going to lead into gardening. But if your listeners don't already know this, you need to hear it again, and that is because there is no GMO wheat in the United States, and for good reason. No one would buy it if it was GMO wheat.
Right.
The salespeople, the sales reps, had been selling glyphosate to wheat farmers to kill the wheat while it's still in the field. The advantage to the farmer is you can predict the time of harvest. And then, you know, the next advantage is it can dry out there on the stalk, and you don't have to spend money at the silo on dryers to get it down to the low enough moisture level so you can actually store it in a silo. And then the disadvantage is almost entirely to the consumer, because now all the wheat, unless it's organically grown, all the wheat in the U.S. is contaminated with glyphosate.
So it's almost like it is a GMO thing, because isn't glyphosate like one of the really bad things about GMOs?
Yeah, I mean, their GMOs are loaded up with glyphosate, and you have to remember, although glyphosate, at least so far as anyone's been able to prove, is not carcinogenic, all the excipient chemicals that go with it so that it will be absorbed into the plant tissue, those are carcinogenic. And that was discovered in Japan when a lot of Japanese gardeners were getting nasal cancer. And they, of course, were applying the glyphosate Roundup material.
Wow.
Just by hand, just walking along in the field and inhaling the mist from the spray cans that they were using. And they were told it was harmless. It didn't do anything. And then the next thing you know, that group had a lot of nasal cancers. And they started looking at what was causing that, and it was apparently the chemicals that go with the glyphosate.
And so what do you think about Dr. Seneff's contention that as these glyphosates are in the soil, they bust the sulfur cycle, and that's really detrimental to the body?
It's extremely detrimental. Sulfur is such an important detoxifying agent for the entire body, and especially for the liver. And, you know, in addition to the fact that the glyphosate is causing a microbe to not function in releasing manganese, not magnesium, but manganese, crops are running out of manganese because it's being tied up due to the fact that it can't be reduced by that microbe. The microbe is the one thing that's affected, and we're not getting manganese into the plant, and that's called crop drag. And it's showing up in corn crops as goss wilt, which used to be a totally insignificant problem in corn and has now become quite significant.
Wow. So when you start messing with Mother Nature, as we've known forever, George, it doesn't end well.
No, it doesn't. Saying goes, Mother Nature bats last.
Hmm. George Altgeld, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. If you'd like to try some of the sulfur, it's really a good one. And it's just pure, and it is available on OneRadioNetwork.com. Three prices, United States, Canada, and worldwide. If you'd like more than 4 pounds, email me, Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Daniel Vitalis, let's play a game. On a desert island, you can only pick one food. Just one. Just only one.
If I had to live off of one food, I think it would be, if I had any choice, it would probably be colostrum. It's the most complete food that I know of. And the thing about colostrum is the first food for any mammal. So it's kind of a no-brainer that colostrum contains all essential fats, it contains all essential amino acids, it contains all essential glyconutrients, which are carbohydrates. It basically contains every substance that we need to maintain our bodies. The first milking you get from a cow after the cow calves is called colostrum. Every milking thereafter is called transitional milk. And what it is it's part colostrum and part milk. So that's something that can happen in the industry because people will sell you the transitional milk and call it colostrum. We're very careful not to do that. We only use the first milking of the animals.
Pure colostrum from SirThrival. They take the moisture out. That's it. To order, click on the picture of colostrum, front page, OneRadioNetwork.com.
Broadcasting live, weekday mornings, this is listener-supported One Radio Network.
Moves upon look at the sun in his jealous sky as we walk in fields of gold. So she took her love for to gaze a while upon the fields of Bali. In his arms she fell as her hair came down among the fields of gold. Will you stay with me? Will you be my love among the fields of Bali? We'll forget the sun in its jealous sky as we lie in fields of gold.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com.
Okay, we're having fun with George Altgelt. He has a great place in Austin, Texas, not far from where I am, and in Dripping Springs. And he's got these piles of soils all over the place. And why do you have so many different kinds of soils out there, geo growers? So just to give people a picture, people around the world listening, your business is kind of fun to people picture, you know, what kind of place you have. So you have all these different soils. I mean, why do you need so many? Why don't you just have one soil and plant your garden and you're done?
What an excellent question.
Yeah,
different kinds of plants have different soil needs. And we have, well, I'll give you the best example, is the geo tree mix.
Uh-huh.
You're going to dig a hole for a tree. Now, the conventional wisdom is this. Just plant that tree in the dirt that came out of the hole.
That's right. It'll work.
Yeah. Well, the dirt that came out of the hole around here is rock chips and caliche. You're not going to have much success growing a tree in rock chips and caliche. For one, that tree is not mature enough to make the most out of that, basically an embarrassment of poverty. You really need to plant it in something where it can get nutrients. The geo tree mix, which is low in compost, it's actually so low in compost that the compost is just being used as an inoculant.
Hmm.
And people will plant a tree as though they were planting a potted plant. And they'll put all this compost in the bottom of the hole and then start filling it up and then put the tree in and fill in around it, and the compost becomes anaerobic. In other words, there's not enough air getting down there to keep the air-breathing microbes alive, so the fermentation microbes, they take the upper hand, and the metabolites that they produce are quite toxic to plants.
Huh.
And you can actually kill plants, a tree, with a high compost environment. So you want to have something that's low enough in compost but high enough so that you actually inoculate the roots with the microbes, and that's where the geo tree mix comes in. And
are we moving into tree planting season now?
You can plant a tree any time of the year,
mm-hmm,
if it is in a container and has roots.
Okay.
Bare root, you want to wait until January or so because you want the tree to be dormant and you want it to go into a situation where it will stay dormant until spring. But container-grown stock, whole different story. You can plant that any time. And I'd highly recommend that you use some kind of soil that's inoculated with the beneficial soil microbes. Now, if you're in Ohio or, Montana, mm-hmm, and a lot of places that have soil,
mm-hmm,
yes, plant the tree in the soil that came out of the hole. But if it's all rocky and inhospitable, don't. Get you something that you know is alive. But don't make that mistake of putting a bunch of compost in there because you don't want to kill the tree.
And what if somebody around the country is going to plant a tree, say, in their front yard or backyard? Do they do that? Same principle. If it's a container, you can do it anytime.
Right. Same principle. And another thing that you want to do is if you're in a low rainfall area and the problem is keeping it watered,
mm-hmm,
and it will be in the beginning because that root ball is the only thing supplying water to the tree. If the root ball dries out, the soil surrounding it can be all wet, and the tree will die from a lack of water. So what you want to do in a low rainfall area is have the root ball planted slightly below the surrounding level of soil or rock, depending on where you're planting it. In some areas, you want the root ball to be somewhat elevated because there's high rainfall and things stay too wet. But in a lot of places, that will kill the tree because rainfall is just too low.
So generally, people around the country can find somebody like you in their area, probably not as clever as you, but get close as you can, to advise you on how to plant that baby and how high and all of these very little important things that most nobody knows except guys like you.
Right, and hopefully you've got a knowledgeable person who's in the area who does landscape and has had, you know, a nice track record with getting trees to survive. That's definitely what you want to seek out anytime you're planting a tree. And, you know, the grandparents, you know, they're probably still well in touch with what it was like, you know, before the pre-industrial age took over and the next thing you know, everybody lives in the city. Find someone who's got some knowledge about that sort of thing.
Yeah. How about the fruit trees like peaches or stuff like that? Are you planting those now around the country? Depends on, I guess, where you are. Either Florida or Minnesota be different.
Right. A young tree in a northern climate can freeze. But I'm so glad you asked that question with regard to peach trees and fruit trees.
Yeah.
Because the main topic I would like for us to address is the widespread use of a pesticide called neonicotinoate.
Yeah, we've heard of those.
And to answer the question, yes, if you're in a temperate zone, you can be planting peach trees right now. You can plant just about anything. I would wait till it starts warming up after winter if you're up in the northern climes, you know, Canada, Minnesota, northern United States. Wait till then. You want the tree to establish itself root-wise before you actually move into, getting a tree in the ground. But here is what's going on with this new pesticide, relatively new, late 90s. It's the neonicotinates. And nicotine is an alkaloid mostly produced by tobacco, but it's almost... It's throughout the entire, almost every different kind of plant in this family called Solanaceae makes a form of nicotine. It's a plant defense chemical. It's an alkaloid. It's for some insects, it's extremely toxic. And the only reason people don't drop dead from smoking a cigarette is because there's very little nicotine in the smoke. But here's what, I believe this is DuPont developed it. They created an isomer of the nicotine alkaloid. In other words, there's a little bit of difference between that nicotine that they've synthesized and the nicotine that naturally occurs in a plant. And that tiny little bit of difference is extremely toxic to insects that don't have livers. And that would be all your pollinators, you know, bees, and there's all these different species of bees. There's bumblebees. In Central Texas, we have 5 different species of bumblebees. There's pollinating flies. There's pollinating flies that look like bees. And then there's flies that look like houseflies. There's horsefly-looking thing. And then there's, you know, there's so many different pollinators, but here's what happens when the plant is taking up the neonicotinoate. And I'll give you an example of where that happened, but I want to just tell you that the neonicotinoate scrambles all the nerve impulses in that tiny insect's brain so that it cannot find its way back home. And in the case of honeybees, it's devastating. The first people that discovered this would notice that, hey, there's no dead bees here. They just didn't come back to the hive. So... Now we're going to switch over. I'm going to tell you what happened in France.
Okay.
That from, you know, there were, you know, assurances from Bayer, who bought the product, who bought the rights to produce it from DuPont. I believe it was DuPont.
Yeah.
And Bayer, a German company, started producing it, and they assured the ag department in France that there would be no harm to the pollinating insect populations. So the way the neonicotinoate is used, and they're called neonics for
neonics,
short.
Yeah.
You coat the seed, and the seed is very poisonous to something that might eat the seed, you know, like cutworm, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So in France, there's a huge industry around sunflower seeds.
Huh?
It's used for oil. It's used for protein. Lots and lots of sunflowers, you know. Hundreds of thousands of acres of sunflowers are grown in France. Well, with these assurances, the French government, the Ag Department, allowed the neonicotinoate as a preventive for insects, and they all planted at the same time. You pretty much plant after the last frost, like you do everywhere else, and they grew up. You know, these are sunflowers that get to be about 5 feet high. And the heads are all, you know, getting ready. The flowers are coming out. And then the next thing you know, the flowers open, and it's a composite. So there's, you know, hundreds of little tiny flowers inside that big sunflower. Well, when the pollen came out, it still had the neonicotinoate in it because it's systemic. And it moved up through the vascular system of the plant, got into the flowers, got into the pollen and the nectar. Well, the bees came along to pollinate it, and they got a dose of neonicotinoate. Now, we're talking tiny, tiny doses. And the next thing you know, some 10 million beehives died. And there was no one could figure out what happened because there were no bees. There were no dead bees. You know, it's like, what's going on? And so all the hatching bees with no one to attend them, they died in the hive. But the main part of the hive, there was no attending bees, no gatherers of honey, no nectar gatherers, no pollen gatherers. They were just gone. And what the French government immediately suspected was the neonicotinoate, because nothing in the history of agriculture in France had ever seen anything like that.
Wow. That's...
And with the assurances of Bayer, oh, no, that could not be. The French government didn't buy it, and they went looking for it all the way down to parts per trillion, and found it to be affecting the bees.
Parts per trillion.
Right.
Man, these little guys are so sensitive, aren't they?
They are. And remember, bees don't have livers. They can't detoxify that.
What do you mean they don't have livers? I've done that. Everyone knows they don't have livers. So that's because they don't live that long, do they, George?
No, they don't. Mother Nature solves the problem of immune systems by having a very high turnover of population.
So
that's how bees survive.
I wonder about that because in places like New Zealand, and there's places here in this country, you can get certified organic honey and pollen because you can prove that within, I don't know, what is it? I think in New Zealand it's 5 miles. It's a pretty strong system they have down there. I've often wondered if the bees do get in some really bad stuff, would they even make it back to the hive?
In many cases, yes. But in the case of neonicotinoate, no.
They just croak.
They don't.
Them. Wow.
And what the French discovered, that even when the levels are so low that they don't affect the bee sipping nectar from a flower, as the rain leaches the neonicotinates into ponds and stock tanks and streams, as little as 4 parts per trillion will affect the bee, and they may make it back to the hive, but it shortens their lives, and they become dysfunctional, even as a worker bee within the hive. And it's like, you know, the French saw it and immediately banned the neonics, but that didn't happen in the U.S. You know, what we've got right now, and you know, not far from us, Patrick, is this wonderful place called Rolling in Thyme and Dough.
Oh, yeah, in Dripping Springs.
In Dripping Springs. And they have the most beautiful peach trees that produce prolifically. They've got a loquat tree, which makes its flowers in the fall and ripens its fruit over the winter. Those flowers are open. There should be bees all over it. And I only saw 2 honeybees, counting 2. and it's got enough flowers, the thing should be buzzing audibly. Really? And I'm not hearing it.
What do you suppose that's about?
Okay, well, I gave this same talk at the Austin Organic Gardening Club, and was talking about neonics, and I cited all this stuff that the French government did to track that down. And a guy in the back raised his hand, and I said, yeah. And he said, I used to work for Home Depot in, it was New Braunfels. He said, the 5 years ago, when we would unload our ornamentals off of the trucks, and, you know, they're flowering ornamentals, he said there would be bees all over the place. I mean, there would be hundreds, if not thousands, of bees all over those flowers. He said, in the next 4 years, that ended.
Wow.
He said, you almost don't even see a single bee when we unload those trucks.
Where'd they all go?
Well, if it's the neonicotinates, they don't go anywhere because they can't figure out where to go. They just die out in the field.
And how are all these neonics getting
into the bee's brain?
Yeah. Oh, no, I mean, how's it getting into the fields and the flowers and all that stuff?
Well, if you're coating the seed for all your commercial varieties
that's
of ornamentals,
crazy, man.
They're coating the seeds.
So they coat, like if you just get an ornamental at a regular nursery place, you're putting neonics in your yard?
Yeah. Yeah. And the residues persist, and it takes the smallest amount.
Wow.
We're talking about down to, you know, parts per billion, certainly, and the French have traced it to 4 parts per trillion will still affect a bee and the neurological systems of the bee.
And what kind of seeds, give us an idea, George Alcott, of the variety of seeds that are being coated. So you're talking food and ornamental seeds?
Right, ornamentals especially. Let's say, pansies, or if it's summertime, you're talking about periwinkles. They're just routinely coating these seeds, and they're not even reducing the amount of loss that much. It's just some really good salesman has said, oh, this will do it. You can guarantee these plants to your customers, and the plant won't die because there's nothing that's going to affect that seed when it starts to sprout and grow.
So if we go down to the Home Depot or a place like that and buy some flowers and put them in flower pots around our house, there's a good chance, or well,
there's a real good chance that flower is already contaminated with neonics.
Oh man, that's not good.
And right now the city of Austin has on their table considerations for banning the neonics within the city limits.
But I'm sure that's pretty rare around the country because Austin's so weird. Right. That's a good news for Austin, but most cities probably have no idea what this neonic.
No, they don't. They don't. And, you know, were it not for the education level of the people that live here, you know, we wouldn't have seen anything like, you know, banning the plastic bags that were blowing everywhere.
Yeah, they did.
And winding up in the Gulf of Mexico.
I don't know if you know this, folks, but in Austin, I mean, you can't even do the plastic bag thing. They just don't allow it. And
right, no. Paper bags, they'll disintegrate biologically.
Mm-hmm.
But the plastic bags, they blow around, they get caught in fences and trees and all this stuff, and it was just becoming really unsightly.
So as a nursery, can you get ornamentals without been coated with the neonics?
Well, I'm not really a nursery. I sell plants
because of
gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the plants that I buy are certified organic. They're coming from Gabriel Valley Farms, and those are certified organic producers. And really, you want some assurance that even if you're not buying from an organic outfit, that they are not using neonics.
Yeah, but I mean, most places, you ask the salesperson or they wouldn't even know, would they?
They wouldn't even know.
They wouldn't know.
No.
They would say,
meanwhile, your peach tree may not have any peaches on it this year because of that. And not because it couldn't flower, and not because it couldn't set fruit, but because there are no bees to pollinate it.
Wow. So do you think that's the one of the key things of why... I know out here, George, where I live, I mean, we used to have kabillions of wasps. I mean, kabillions, right?
Right, and wasps, they're very important predators.
Yeah, and they don't, you know, they're hardly, they're, you know, two or three.
Right.
I mean, and this is just 5 years ago.
Right, exactly.
So
what's happening?
Yeah.
I mean, wasps are pollinators. If they drink that nectar,
mm-hmm.
which they use for energy, what's happening? And, you know, the neonics are so potent when it comes to brain chemistry of an insect that they could just be unable to find their way back to that nest. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of wasps because they are so predatory. They really keep a handle on...
A lot of things, right?
A lot of things.
Ticks.
You know, kid caterpillars, for example.
Yeah. Also, I think they eat ticks, don't they?
You know, they might. And that's another good reason to preserve your fire ants.
You bet.
Fire ants cleaning out the ticks. And boy, do we need that because we got Lyme's disease in Texas big time.
You know, I had a lot of ticks a few years ago, and I didn't have any fire ants. I don't know why. So I went to a friend's place. He's got about 20 acres, and I went around with shopping bags or trash bags. And, man, we imported fire ants all over my land.
Right.
And I don't have any ticks now.
Right. You know, in the old days, you know, you would believe the people who were selling fire ant poison.
Well, they still do. I hear it on the radio. It's like they think they're terrorists. They're going to kill them all.
You would think that a fire ant man could devour a toddler in under 6 minutes. Yeah, if you listen, I mean, that's the impression you come away with.
Yeah, that's right. I know. It's like, you got to kill these guys. They will kill you.
Right.
And they have all these things. Wow. Man, oh, man. I just sure miss all the wasps. And, you know, we had our beautiful sage, you know, the purple sage bushes.
Mm-hmm.
I have some around the house, and they bloomed about six times this year. I don't know what's up with that. They were just—they don't generally bloom about one or two times, right? But
well, here's the deal with sage, and landscapers all call it by this name, barometer bush.
Oh.
And they start blooming before it rains.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah. And always the question is, how do they know?
but they had some bees out there for them. But not a lot. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Not a lot like we used to have. So that's really sad. Is that going on all over the country?
It pretty much is. And they're trying to keep these various bee organizations silent. And that was one of the brutal discoveries by the gentleman who wrote the article in Acres USA, which, by the way, you can access at the GeoGrower's website.
Okay.
Go to the website and just look at the front page, and you'll find a way to get to this article. This is the guy who's like on the forefront of, exposing the neonicotinoid problem.
Oh, cool. At geogrowers.com.
Right. Or
geogrowers.net.
Yeah, that's our website, I'm pretty sure. Denise knows.
No, I got it. I got it up here. So you have a link here if you want to read that. On your front page?
Yeah, the article is just fascinating, if not heartbreaking.
And how do you find the article? I'm looking here. Well, we'll do it during a commercial. You find out where it
sure,
is. And see.
Sure, sure.
So.
But what he discovered was that he was going to be a speaker at a bee organization, because
right.
this guy knows a lot about honeybees.
Right.
And they disinvited him.
Ooh.
And then he found out that they had been bribed with a paltry $40,000 to shut up about neonicotinoids.
Did he take the 40 grand?
No, he didn't take it. It was the bee organization that took it.
Oh, well, that's...
That's why they disinvited him to speak.
Wow.
And $40,000 is nothing. I mean, these people are reaping the profits in the billions selling neonicotinoids globally.
Well, what's their motive? I mean... You could get really dark and think there's a lot of people that just want to kill us, but you know what I mean? I mean, the whole eugenics thing, but let's put that to the side and say, well, let's think the best of them. They don't really want to kill us. Why would they just to sell the whole neonicotinoate technology? That'd be the motive?
Well, it represents sales. And, you know, the crops that they're, you know, promoting, which would be soybeans and corn, those are not bee pollinated. They don't require pollinators. They're just wind pollinated. So it's not going to hurt the big consumers of the neonicotinoids. Now, bees will go there and gather pollen from those because that's the bread of the beehive. They use pollen as protein, and they feed it to the little baby bees who are emerging. The nectar turns into honey. That's what they use for energy. But they also have to have water. A bee will fly as far as 3 miles to get water.
3 miles.
Right. And, you know, you've got to have, you know, that kind of distance between a contaminated area and the hive if you're going to call your honey organic.
Yeah. I think, if I can recall, I think the standard in New Zealand is 5 miles. They get a little buffer there. So if you can get New Zealand, like the Manuka honey, you're pretty sure it's going to be clean.
Right, right. And, you know, as far as I know, the big pesticide companies have not got that much of a foothold in New Zealand. I'm sure they're working every day for new inroads. But
yeah. Boy, they do in Australia. You know, we talked to Scott Tipps, who's an attorney. He works for the Health Freedom Council, and he goes out to all the Codex meetings around the world. He's really a cool guy. And he says that Australia is one of the most brain-dead corporate globalist countries on the planet. And you wouldn't think of that of Australia.
No, you wouldn't.
I know. He said they just don't get it. He said, you talk about deer in the headlights. When he talks to them about wanting to do this or do that or get together and to get enough votes for this. And man, he said they are just the worst. Isn't that amazing? It really surprised me.
Yeah. This is the first I've heard of it.
But New Zealand's cool. They're pretty cool. They get it. You know, they got more cows than people in New Zealand, or more sheep, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, more sheep. Of course, we have a lot of sheeple here, but you know they.
Yeah, they're in offices, but they're all behind fences.
No, they all voted for Hillary. No, okay. So, okay, let's do a break here, and we'll be right back. Daniel Vitalis, your pine pollen has been around for many years and really getting some good results with testosterone building for guys. How does it work?
Well, it works by actually containing phytotestosterone. It's very similar to when people use a bioidentical testosterone, except it's in a plant form and it's readily usable by the body. So many people have turned to bioidentical testosterone without looking to nature to see what options are out there. Pine pollen contains not only testosterone, but it's also got DHEA and a few other anabolic hormones as well. So if somebody's looking to increase the testosterone in their body and looking to have more anabolic function, then pine pollen's a really good alternative to some of the pharmaceutical therapies people have been turning to.
And so much easier on the body than the synthetic form. And we have pine pollen and all Sirthrival links on sale right now, 10% off through November 7th. Promo code ONERADIO. Any Sirthrival link right now. Click and order oneradionetwork.com. That's going to be midnight tonight, I suspect, because I'm going to order a couple of things and I'm going to get my 10% just like you. Just like you. 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at oneradionetwork.com. Previously, a caller from California talked about the wildfires and the rebounder.
She was talking about our issues with the wildfire smoke here and our lymph nodes backing up. But your rebounder, that really, I think, has been very helpful just going and doing like you said you do. You bounce a couple of minutes every hour or so. I really feel like that has benefited me quite a bit in getting the lymph flowing around, because we're both real active. We're runners and cyclists, and with the smoke, you don't want to go out and suck a lot of that deep into your lungs, so it's really nice to have that available to just go a little bounce a couple minutes every hour to help move things around. And you can feel it. I mean, to me, when I start noticing that the back of my head's getting kind of plugged up and I can feel, you know, my neck tightening up and that kind of stuff, I just go down there and I hop on it and bounce for 2 or 3 minutes. And I can really feel the flow just start moving again.
Yes, these are really nice units. Lifetime warranty, too. The Rebound Air Rebounder, you can click and order on the front page of our website. And $339 delivered, Continental U.S. live outside of there, just email me and we'll work it out. Click and order, front page, the Lifetime Warranty Rebound Air Rebounder, OneRadioNetwork.com. Previously with Andrew Goss, I asked him why would someone want to buy coins from his company?
So if you don't know coins, you better know your coin dealer. And, you know, you shouldn't buy coins from someone who isn't well-known registered dealer. So if they're an NGC dealer, they're registered with NGC. If they're a PCGS dealer, they're registered with PCGS. Ask questions. Don't just, oh, yeah, here's 10 grand or 50 grand or 150 grand. I just want to buy coins, you know, let me know what I'm getting. And no, that's not how an intelligent investor does it. And we do not let you do that. So if you're not willing to learn about the coins that you're buying, maybe you should find another coin firm. Don't call this one, because we're going to insist that you know why and how a coin is rare. And once you know that, then I think you can take that knowledge into the marketplace and make intelligent investment decisions.
Aha, what a concept, intelligent investment decisions. I've known Andrew for 25 years. He's the real deal. His company, STL 800-468-2646. Give him a call if you're interested.
We are listener supported. One Radio Network. We talk about your health, wealth, and well-being on OneRadioNetwork.com. Once again, here's Patrick.
What a great song. George Altgeld is here. George is a good friend, and he has a great spot in Austin, Texas. If you ever come to town, come out to Dripping Springs, right there on the county line, and visit Geo Growers. And he's got a great staff, and Your one of your employees, Matt.
Matt.
They live in the next property over, and they cleaned out a big swimming hole for a lot of different sediment, you know, that settled in over the years on our creek.
Yes.
And he's got this tractor, and so he dug all these things. Man, he worked and they worked and worked piles and piles and piles. And he calls me up and say, hey, we got a bunch of this stuff. You want me to put some on your driveway? You know, because I have this rock driveway and it's always got big holes in it because of the rain.
Right.
So God love him. He came over and, man, mine looked like I have a new driveway. Just,
wow.
And I got a big long driveway too. I mean, really long all the way up to the street. He's such a nice man. So you tell him I said hi. And
I will.
Yeah, yeah. He lives right next door, you know.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah, I've been out there. It's a nice place they have out there.
Yeah, well, I'm the property just next to them. Yeah, that's where I live. Well, George, let's talk gardening here a little bit. So I thought that we would help folks grow some vegetables like now.
Yes.
No matter where they live, apartment, house, outside, greenhouse. So let's go inside. Is it actually possible to put some vegetable plants in your window or somewhere and grow something? I mean, don't we need so much sun? How does that work?
Yes, you can grow indoors, and you have to put the plants right in the window, and mm-hmm. I highly recommend that you get lights for those plants
okay.
because there's a certain requirement of ultraviolet.
Mm-hmm.
And the ultraviolet is how the plants can build and assimilate the polyphenolic compounds, which are so beneficial for us when we eat the plants, but they're also beneficial for the plants because that's how they defend themselves. But that's how you make really good plants that have immune systems, and we get that benefit when we eat the plant. It builds our immune system.
So we don't have enough sunlight now to grow things in the windows. We need to supplement
not,
with light.
Right? Well, there's exceptions to that. Mm-hmm. You know, how thick is the glass? The thicker the glass, the more it cuts out the ultraviolet. There are lights that produce ultraviolet that'll get you the what's required for that plant.
Are these common grow lights you see? Is that what these are called?
A lot of them are common grow lights. Mm-hmm. You can get them from, you know, I would go to a reputable firm that sells that kind of stuff for indoor gardening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're going to be all up on what's required to keep that plant healthy.
Do you just leave that light on all the time, even when the sun is shining?
Well, remember, indoors, your eyes adjust to the light, and you don't really realize how dim it is.
Okay.
But if you were dependent on the light coming into the house for all your food energy, it would be a different story. But to answer your question appropriately, those lights need to be off at night because the plants do need periods of darkness.
They need to sleep too.
Yes.
Well, you know, 20, 30 years ago, well, 40 years ago, we grew wacky tobacco inside, right?
Right.
No, I mean, that's,
people did. Yeah,
I know. We used lights, those lights. Of course, I never got it to work. I wasn't very good at it, but there are people that. But I remember when I used to grow years ago wheatgrass, and we did it on wire shelves inside, and we had those lights. It works good.
Yes. Yeah. And there's a lot of wheatgrass being grown in Austin, and they all use lights.
They all use lights. Okay. So. Is a grow light the same, George Altgeld, as a full spectrum light?
It very well could be, and that's where you probably want to go to a reputable dealer so you can ask these questions and get good answers.
Mm. So what kind of soil, if folks say, wow, this is great, I'm going to try to grow some vegetables on my, you know, whatever, near my big picture window in my living room. It's a nice thing to have plants, right? And you could set up the lights and get a stand and shine them on them. What kind of a soil was going to be the best for something like this?
Okay, you need soil that's biologically active.
Biologically.
In other words, it has, you know, all the various micro populations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many different kinds of microbes.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the guys responsible for getting the nutrients into the plant through the roots. It's microbes and fungi. That's how it works. So you want a living soil, and then you also want soil to be loaded up with trace minerals. And certainly you want a balance of trace minerals. And at my store, we sell fertilizers where a great deal of attention is paid to trace minerals.
So can folks buy bagged soil around the country that they could talk to the people there, and it would say bioactive and it's living trace minerals? I mean, you got to trust to kind of know the source a little bit where you're buying this stuff, huh?
Oh, well, you certainly do. But I will say this, most of the bagged soil that I see
mm-hmm.
is basically ground up wood.
Oh, good. Is that not good?
That's not good.
Okay, not good.
Because that does not foster a soil ecology.
Okay.
And the reason why it's mostly ground up wood is because of its lightweight character, and they want it as lightweight as they can get it, because when you're buying something that came halfway across the United States, you're buying a bag of freight before you're buying anything.
So you're going to have to know the source, which is our trademark, and go to a place that you trust that they're going to tell you where you have a living soil bioactive, and it really is.
Exactly.
Or it's on the label, too.
Exactly.
Would it be on the label?
It can. I mean, I sell potting soil, and that's what the label is all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's
mm-hmm.
biologically activated, and, you know, this and that, and trace mineral sources are listed, and that
sure,
sort of thing.
Sure, sure. When we're putting trace minerals, like, for vegetables that we're growing inside, and before we ask that, can we pretty much grow anything inside, or what would be some of the vegetables that would do the best to be inside this winter people want to try it?
Sure. Herbs are really great to grow indoors when you put them in a window. You've got to have bright enough light or the plant just starts losing ground. You know, again, that's the actual food source for any plant is the light and how much light there is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's called plant food, you know, in the old days, that was always chemical fertilizers.
Sure.
Yes, those are the raw materials. Those are the raw building blocks. But the actual food is light energy.
Can you grow regular old vegetables like tomatoes or squash or anything like that? Probably difficult.
Yes, and that's putting mildly. Tomatoes, for example, you know, don't do well if they're getting anything less than 6 hours of direct sunlight outside.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes growing tomatoes in a greenhouse pretty difficult. Most people don't have a greenhouse to start with.
Yeah.
If they have a greenhouse, it's got a lot of shade. And if you're using, you know, glass, well, it's filtering out a lot of ultraviolet, and even plastic films will cut out a lot of ultraviolet. And that's what makes growing tomatoes in a hothouse or a greenhouse difficult. And where that is being done successfully, that greenhouse is pretty much out in full sun.
Full sun, yeah. So are we kind of limited to herbs inside?
Not necessarily.
No.
If you go to your supplier that's got lights for growing stuff indoors.
Okay.
You can grow a lot of vegetables inside.
Really? Like what kind of things?
Well, you know, you could grow a lot of leafy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Cabbage and kale. But remember, it's going to take a lot of light, and most of these plants are used to having the sun track across the sky.
Yeah.
So you're going to have lights not just overhead but off to the side. And there's other things you could grow. I would say if you've got the time and you can afford the lighting, do it, because everything you do along those lines is going to be good for you.
Yeah, yeah. And of course you could do wheatgrass if you want, and you could do sunflowers, right? Sunflower sprouts?
Right.
Kind of thing.
Yes.
Sprouts too. Do you mess around with sprouts much?
No, I don't. I usually don't have time for it. I barely have time to do any gardening.
Yeah, well, that's because you're a business typhoon, you know?
Yeah, right. Was that a typhoon?
A typhoon? No, a typhoon. Yeah, a business typhoon. I used to be a business typhoon, and now I'm just a little hurricane. There's a little machine that we have in our store, George, that's really cool. They got about five or six trays, and you put the seeds in the tray after you soak them, and then it got timers on it, and so four or five times a day it just sprays the water, and you should see these little sprouts, man. They just go crazy, Maisie. I mean, have you ever seen these things?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, they're about 3 feet long, 4 feet long, 2 feet, 3 feet wide. You put them on your counter. You just need a little tube coming down into a bucket, because it drains the water when it sprays it, but it's pretty cool. You can grow a lot of sprouts. I grew more sprouts than I knew what to do with, and so I'm about to get it out now. I like to do it in the wintertime and have, sprouts to eat. And
oh, sure. Yeah, that's, it's a great source of vitamin C. And
oh, man, yeah.
It got the soil laced with trace minerals. It's a good source of trace minerals. The one thing I do want to say about trace minerals, and this is why it's being looked at much more carefully, not only is the plant making all of its defense chemicals,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, the polysaccharides and the polyphenols, the alkaloids, the aromatics. These are all plant defense substances. I hesitate to call them chemicals because they're not, man-made. They are plant-made. But they contribute heavily to our health.
They're the bomb, right? They're the bomb.
Yeah. They're, divinely inspired. This is how plants have lived, for millions and millions of years without any intervention.
Okay, let's really dig into trace minerals, because this is the key to the whole deal, right? So do we put organic or inorganic trace minerals in our soil?
Well, remember, if we're talking minerals, we're talking about items that you would routinely find on the periodic chart of the elements.
Okay.
And they can either be bound up with other molecules, or they can be free. Monoatomic elements are, they're everywhere. But there's some things that are bound up with others, and you can't do much with it. One of the best things that, I'd like to say is, iodine, for example. It's a halogen. It's hungry to fill its outer electron shell with that last electron, and so it binds with just about anything, as do all the other halogens, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, iodine, as the British say, or astatine. But anyway, those are, when you can get them ionic, that's a really good thing, like in Lugol's solution, or in a food matrix like seaweed.
Seaweed
is an excellent source of iodine and other trace minerals. But the trace minerals are how your liver detoxifies itself from very complex, very toxic substances, including heavy metals. And you've got to have trace minerals so that the liver can build these compounds that are essential for getting itself cleaned. And that lady who was talking about sulfur, man, play that ad every chance you get, because our foods are so deficient in sulfur. And it is a big deal for the liver to have enough sulfur to make all those compounds that it uses to detoxify itself. And, you know, and not just sulfur. They're all important. But sulfur is the one that we're so deficient in, and we need sulfur. And elemental sulfur is for the human body, and then for the garden, don't use elemental sulfur for one. It's too costly. But the other thing is elemental sulfur will actually kill plants. What you want to use is mined sulfur, the yellow powder sulfur. That's what soil needs. And again, let's talk about balance. You don't want to overdo that. Too much sulfur in your garden is not a good thing. You know, all of these trace minerals require a balance. They're all set within a specific, proportions to one another.
George Oakald, are there not substances like different rocks or dust or, I don't know, things, mineral substances that you can put in the garden that gives you a good broad spectrum of trace minerals so you don't have to do a little of this, a little of that?
Yes, there are. Anything
that's
that derived from once living material, fish emulsion is a really good example.
Fish emulsion, huh?
Yeah, that creature was once alive and, as such, had a whole complement of trace minerals that enabled it to be alive. And then bat guano, same story there.
Bat poop, good. We like bat poop, yeah.
Or as Native Americans say, dung heap of bat.
Dung heap of bat, yes.
Bat anyway, <poop. laughs> those substances are full of trace minerals because the bat ate the insect, the indigestible parts were the shell of the bat, and it's made up of trace minerals as well as, you know, the proteins and amino acids and fats and all of that. Anyway, that's all intact in the bat poop.
Okay. Let's go to the phone. On the telephone, who's this?
Hi, Patrick. It's Amanda Love.
Hello, Amanda Love. Amanda, do you know George?
Hi. I don't think I've had the pleasure of meeting him, but I've met his amazing soil in my garden right now.
Oh, it is. See, Amanda lives out near...
Wonderful.
Amanda's a good friend. She lives out near us, George. What's up, girl?
Well, I have a very successful garden thanks to this amazing soil. I had about, I think, 5 yards of it delivered a couple months ago to help my raised beds.
Some
enhancement, and things are growing really well. But I'm having some issues with these little white moths that are eating all my brassica leaves.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Young.
Yeah, they're white and they're eating like your broccolis and things like that.
Those plants are still growing. You know, they're not fully matured yet, and I haven't gotten. They're eating my arugula and my cauliflower, broccoli, and cabbage.
Well, they have good taste,
is there,
Amanda.
They have good taste.
Yeah. They came to an organic place. You know, they're not stupid.
Yes, that's right. So, is there anything I can do about that, George?
Yes. Okay, the first thing you need to know is it's still not cold enough to take that plant out of stress. That's why all those brassicas are under stress, because we're just not in the cold weather yet. And the stress is what's making them susceptible to, could be white fly. But the best way to deal with white fly is the All Seasons oil spray. Now, in the old days, we would use the so-called dormant oil, which you could not use in hot weather. But All Seasons oil spray can be used no matter how hot it is, and it suffocates the insects. insect, and the oil itself evaporates in about 3 days. It's totally gone.
And what's it made out of?
It's made out of a paraffinic oil, a very thin oil, and it's mixed with a small amount of ammonia so that it will dissolve in water. And you spray that on the plant. It's not toxic to anything except an insect, and it coats them, and it coats up their little breathing gills, which are right where the leg joins the body of the insect, and it will actually suffocate them. But if it's not too big of a problem, you could even wait, because when cold weather finally gets here, you won't see those.
They're just kind of stressed because it's too warm. But if Amanda wanted to get that, where would she get that?
Well, I have it here at the store.
Right down the street. Yeah, there you go.
You should be able to buy it anywhere, but don't let someone sell you something poisonous. For one, it doesn't work very well. And then two, we're talking about 100% effective if you use the oil and get it on them.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I definitely wouldn't use anything poisonous. I'm totally organic and natural.
Yes.
So, okay, that's good to know. Right now, while the plants are young, those moths are eating so many holes in them that they're having a hard time getting a foothold, so it seems like that would be really helpful.
Sure, and you might. What do you use for a fertilizer right now?
I'm using this like a marine fish emulsion stuff from Natural Gardener.
Okay, all right. As long as it's got some fish in it, one common mistake is people will use seaweed fertilizer, and that's mostly potassium, and there's no nitrogen to build proteins with. And then the plants, they can be quite healthy, but they're not going to grow much because there's no nitrogen due to the fact that there's no proteins. All of that is still missing from the big three, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium.
Okay. So I have everything in your awesome soil, plus soil from my land that I already have things growing in. And that and using a regular good fertilizer, like fish emulsion, I should be set. Is that really all I need? Or should I continue to add more amendments, minerals, things like that?
No, I don't think you'll need to add any more minerals and amendments, but I do want to say this about everything in the brassica family, and this is especially Brussels sprouts. Brussels sprouts are totally amazing in how much they have to have nitrogen. That has got to be the heaviest feeder I have ever encountered. And you're probably going to have to put the fish emulsion on there about once a week.
Okay, good. Yeah, I have those Brussels sprouts too, and mustard as well. Okay, so once a week's not too much. That's good to know.
Right, right. But yeah, if you stay at it, you'll grow your big old tall stalk of Brussels sprouts.
Wow.
Awesome. That's what I want. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Well, you're quite welcome.
I'll come by your store soon.
Oh, wonderful. I'd love to meet you in person. Give us a call. Make sure I'm here.
Okay. I'll probably come today. I'm not sure.
Okay. Wonderful.
Thanks, Amanda. See you soon.
Thank you, Patrick.
Say hi to Ron.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Her husband's my acupuncturist.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, he's really good.